This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The film Hotel Rwanda and debate about ethnic massacres in the Darfur region of Sudan have stirred bitter memories of the world's failure to stop the Rwandan genocide in 1994. With that in mind, today we return to Terry's interview with Canadian General Romeo Dallaire, who took over the command of the UN Observer mission in Uganda and Rwanda a few months before the violence began. When Dallaire arrived, Rwanda was negotiating a peace agreement to end its civil war. But in April of 1994, the plane carrying the Hutu president of Rwanda was shot down. Hutu extremists accused ethnic Tutsis of the assassination and began a massacre that turned into a genocide. An estimated 800,000 Rwandan men, women, and children were murdered in 100 days. Unable to stop the slaughter, General Dallaire remained in Rwanda and tried to protect as many people as he could. In September, he returned home. 4 years later, he testified at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. After that, he said his mind and body decided to give up. Suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, he was given a medical discharge from the Army in 2000. He's now special advisor to the Canadian government on war-affected children. He describes his memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, as a story of betrayal, failure, naivete, indifference, inhumanity, and evil. His book is now out in paperback. Terry spoke with General Dallaire last year.
Now, the genocide started after the president of Rwanda was shot down in his plane on April 6th of 1994. At what point did you realize that the world in Rwanda was about to change?
Oh, well, the workups to the actual event had made the scenario very, very complex and very tense. So we were already in an atmosphere of either a resolution or a blowout. And we were sort of sitting, monitoring both sides and anticipating, hopefully, a positive one, but very much aware that a negative solution might be coming, and that is a humanitarian catastrophe, as we had been informed. And so when the president's plane went down, my first reaction was that the whole mission, the whole scenario is at risk. But it took till the next afternoon, within about 24 hours, when the rebel forces decided to start fighting, that the full realization that the mission formally was now ended and that we were in the middle of a civil war and what looked like something moving away from ethnic cleansing very much towards a genocide.
Do you remember hearing the broadcasts on the radio that urged Hutus to start killing Tutsis?
Well, those broadcasts were given in Kinyarwanda, so they rarely spoke in French or in English, which I speak. And so they were always, when we were able to get the people, finally translated for us. And yes, I still have transcripts of those very explicit instructions given by that extremist radio to people to where to go kill the Tutsis, how to kill them, making sure that they killed the children, because the rebels that are attacking now are the children of those that they had killed in the 50s, but had omitted to kill those children.
At what point did you realize that what was happening in Rwanda went beyond civil war, that it was actually turning into genocide?
Well, by the fourth day in that ballpark, we had seen that the political decapitation had ebbed. In fact, literally, all moderate Tutsi or Hutu leaders of any sort were targeted, and they had been on lists, and the extremists knew exactly where they lived, had targeted them and went in and killed the bulk of them with their families, with some of them escaping and some of them we were able to get out. And then the killings continued. And by then, the term ethnic cleansing was very much in use. I had already sent from my previous command troops to Yugoslavia and so on, so that was what we thought was evolving. And it took, in fact, right up to around the 26th that I finally agreed with the ICRC, the International Red Cross representative, as we discussed this absolutely catastrophic continuum of slaughter, that we were in the middle of a genocide. And it took that long because, to me, genocide was equivalent to Holocaust. That's how we had been educated. And so I just couldn't imagine a Holocaust. And so it took time to finally grasp the fact that this was a genocide, and we had to influence the international community accordingly.
Much of the genocide in Rwanda was carried out with machetes. How did the fact that that's the way so many of the murders were being accomplished, how did that affect your mission in terms of what you needed to do to protect people, in terms of what the medical needs of the people around you were like? And
well, it's one of the most horrific ways of killing people. I mean, in regards to young children, it's very effective because their heads come off rapidly, or they can cut them in two. But with adults, you got to hack and slash a couple times. And these extremists, the militias and so on, at times were drugged up or boozed up and had been killing all day. So it's very fatiguing. And so what they resorted to is, instead of ensuring the people were dead, is that they injured them enough that they were immobile and that they would bleed to death. And so ultimately what happened is that you had people literally dying over days in the heat and or in the thrown still alive, but suffering in latrines and situations like that, or thrown into the water injured and still alive, not able to save themselves. And those scenarios created incredible moral dilemmas, in as much as there was in large parts of Rwanda up to 30% of HIV/AIDS before the war started, and soldiers don't run around with rubber gloves, and so the blood was all over the place. And to what extent do those soldiers expose themselves in helping people to contracting HIV/AIDS? And it was interesting that the bulk of the forces that I had responded that they would not put their lives of their soldiers at risk in trying to save these people in any way, shape, or form because of HIV/AIDS. But a few countries said that AIDS or no AIDS, if people are suffering, their guys would go in.
Could you have gotten a shipment of rubber gloves from the UN?
I couldn't even get ammunition.
You couldn't get food. What am I thinking? Yeah.
There was nothing coming in. We had been totally and completely abandoned.
Early in the genocide, there was a radio station that was exhorting its listeners to kill Tutsis. A little later into the genocide, one of the people on the radio, I believe, was exhorting its listeners to kill you. And I think they were identifying you as the white man with the mustache.
Yes.
What can you tell us about what was actually said in the broadcast?
Well, the broadcast indicated that I, through my work, was sympathetic to the rebels, and that, in fact, wherever I went, the rebels would be following within a week or two. And the reason that they used that is the fact that whenever I met with the extremist leaders, they were so terrible in defending their positions in the Civil War Act part of it, is that they would often be overrun by the RPF. And so the radio simply made it clear that people, if they saw me, should kill me, because I was essentially working for the other side. And so when that came out, I had still some white officers, and some of them had mustaches, Europeans, and they all started to become targets, and people had to fight off mobs and the like. So I had to order their evacuation just for their own safety.
Because they were white and had mustaches?
Yes, and they looked a bit like me, and it was close enough for the mob.
Did you shave?
No.
Really? Why not? If they're looking for a mustache, why not take it off?
No, there was no way that I was going to camouflage myself. In fact, I never even changed a uniform to be in combat uniform. I remained in my dress that I always had even before the war. I wore a flak jacket, and then because of the threat, I was ordered to carry a pistol. I would not always go in my 4x4. I would at times, depending on where I was going, use an APC, though.
What's an APC?
An armored personnel carrier.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did anyone come close to fulfilling the command to kill you?
Yes.
What happened?
I'm not going to talk about it.
Canadian General Romeo Dallaire speaking with Terry Gross. Dallaire commanded the UN peacekeeping forces in Rwanda in 1994. His memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, is now out in paper. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with Romeo Dallaire, the Canadian general who led the UN peacekeeping mission in Rwanda just before and during the 1994 genocide. His memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, describes his predicament during the massacres, commanding a few hundred soldiers who were allowed to use their weapons only in self-defense. They were surrounded by murdering mobs, cut off from the rest of the world.
What do you think the rest of the world could have done? You said the world abandoned you. You had no connection at all with the outside world. What do you think could have been done to help the troops and to help the people who were being massacred?
Well, before the actual war for about 3 months, the world or the bodies of decision knew the incredibly high risks of this peacekeeping mission failing, and that we would be faced with a catastrophic failure because we had had an informant that described exactly ultimately what happened. But there was absolutely no will in anybody to either send us troops nor to change the mandate to permit me to curtail the actions of the extremists in their training, distribution of arms, and the like. And so for those 3 months, no one was interested in giving me more capability to prevent the genocide or the civil war to be launched. Once it was launched, then nations that have the capability of deploying troops rapidly to destroy right at the essence the destructive forces, the militias, so that it wouldn't propagate throughout the country, and in fact we would stop the killing very rapidly. Those countries that deliberately took decisions not to intervene. I mean, the Americans on the morning of the 7th of April were barely 12 hours into this situation in the Security Council in their working room, told everybody that not only were they not going to intervene, but they were going to help nobody who wanted to. And when I had up to four Franco-African countries already to send me troops, but they couldn't get there because there was no strategic lift, and once on the ground they had no equipment, it was a deliberate actions that Rwanda and Rwandans simply don't count. Because as that's going on, we're pouring tens of thousands of troops and billions of dollars into ex-Yugoslavia. And the question is how come one gang get all that support and the other gang gets nothing? And what we saw in the lack of depth of the media, they came in to take the pictures of the gore, but absolutely had no depth into why this was happening and why it was significant, in as much as they turned it into banal tribalism. And it was not tribalism. It was people, extremists who didn't want to give up power, didn't want to share power, and aligned themselves in a way that they were going to eliminate the potential enemy, which happened to be in one particular tribal group. So as we banalize Rwanda, it's of no strategic value, geography, no strategic value, resources, it's only got tea and coffee. And as one officer told me, you know, he said the only thing in Rwanda are humans, and there's already too many of them. It's overpopulated. And so as we banalize that and don't want to get involved in a very messy situation in Rwanda with blacks in Africa killing each other, Yugoslavia, that's different. This is more sophisticated. You know, these are great religions who have been in friction for so long, and their ethnicities have evolved. People have studied it. You got the Ottoman Empire impact. Oh, yes, and they were allies in Second World War, and we know some of them. And so they're very important. And the fact that they were in Europe makes them only more important, and ultimately probably because they were white made them that important. And that's why the Yugoslavia got everything.
Even though the former Yugoslavia got much more in the way of military support and other support from Western countries, the role of peacekeepers, of UN peacekeepers there, has been questioned by many people. I'm wondering, just from your experience in Rwanda, what do you think we need to be rethinking about the role of peacekeepers and the resources that we give them?
What the peacekeepers today require is a whole set of new skills based on far more an intellectual basis than the pure warrior ethic that is trying to be watered down. And so what we're looking for today is, in fact, people who can be warriors, but also have the intellectual depth to be able to be conflict resolvers, and so be value-added and be in the alleyways and talking with the people and helping them resolve the problems. And so that's why we want the officers, particularly in middle powers, to have skills and knowledge, particularly in anthropology and sociology and philosophy, so they can grasp the complexities of this era, because this era is not like before. The post-Cold War era of conflict is exceptionally complex. It is incredibly ambiguous. And generals who run around the countryside saying that they shouldn't go in unless they have clear mandates and extra strategies and they're fearful of mission creep are people who are living in the wrong era.
General Dallaire, your book, Shake Hands with the Devil, is about your experiences leading the peacekeeping troops, the UN peacekeeping troops in Rwanda just before and during the genocide. The title again is Shake Hands with the Devil. In your book, you write, "In Rwanda, I shook hands with the devil, so I know there is a God. I know the devil exists, and therefore I know there is a God." Who is the devil? Do you think of the devil that you shook hands with as being one person or more of a group phenomenon?
Well, there was one person in particular, and in fact, there were his sort of sidekicks in the militia leaders. I had to negotiate with these guys, although I had an option also shooting them between the eyes, but I'm not sure that would have provided anything, for their structures were so strong that they would have replaced them, and then the whole force would have been again vulnerable. But what I saw in those people, in their eyes, was not the eyes of human beings, it were the eyes of evil. And I call it the devil because that my religion sort of qualifies us at that. And they were the devil. They were the evil. They had blood on their shirts. I mean, they could negotiate with me with no passion whatsoever, simply saying, yeah, okay, we'll stop massacring here so that you can move, people between the lines for about 2 hours, and then we'll start up again. And so the human beings don't talk of that nature. It is another entity. Even their hands were cold, but it was like a death cold. Death cold is not a temperature, it's a state. And so I was absolutely talking, negotiating, and touching what I would qualify as the most evil, and it is the devil.
When you were meeting with the men who you came to think of as the devil,
yes.
You said you could have shot them between the eyes, but it probably wouldn't have done any good. Was there ever a moment where you thought, maybe I should shoot them between the eyes? And was the moment when you thought maybe they'd shoot you between the eyes? Because certainly you were their enemy.
It's interesting that on one occasion I actually took all the bullets out of my pistol and made sure I didn't have them available in one of my meetings with them because of some of the sights I'd been seeing that day and the night before. Them shooting me, on the contrary, the fact that I was meeting with them to negotiate the transfer of people between the lines gave them a great sense of importance. They were actually meeting the general of the UN. I mean, he wants to see us, militia leaders, and not just the extremist generals. To them, it was a high point.
You emptied out your gun because you were afraid you would shoot them if you didn't do that?
Well, certainly the emotional position was that strong.
You went back to Rwanda for the 10th anniversary of the genocide.
Yes.
How did the country look to you, and was it helpful to you personally to go back there and see how the country had changed?
Well, I'm not sure if it's helpful in the full sense, because it seemed to be I was a bit zombie-esque. But the country is in much better shape. The beauty of it is still there. The warmth of many of the Rwandans is there, but very few friends have survived. And so it was a bit lonely on that side. And whenever I was looking at these sites all rebuilt, what was coming like a teleprompter in front of my eyes were the scenes in fast forward of what they looked like during the genocide. So it was good to touch base, but I don't think the shoe has dropped yet on its full impact on me.
General Dallaire, thank you very much for talking with us. I really appreciate you reflecting with us on your experiences. Thank you. Yeah. And I wish you all the best.
Well, you're very kind, and your questions were excellent.
Canadian General Romeo Dallaire speaking last year with Terry Gross. Dallaire is now Special Advisor to the Canadian Government on War-Affected Children. His memoir, Shake Hands with the Devil, is out in paperback. A documentary about Dallaire, also called Shake Hands with the Devil, will be shown at the Sundance Film Festival, which begins today in Salt Lake City.